From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 2005, when Poetry magazine editor Christian Wyman was 39, he had a big cancer scare. It was there, it was bad, it was painful, he could die. That, it turns out, changes the way even a poetry editor reads poetry. It turned Wyman fast to a deeper, more urgent reading, and to God. He survived. He's with us this hour on Point, Poetry and Spirituality at Death's Door. You can join the conversation. What's helped you in the hardest times, even facing death? Is there a passage, a poem, that got you through, that made sense of it, carried you? Christian Wyman joins me now from Chicago. He has survived his cancer's onset and written about the journey it put him on. His book is My Bright Abyss, Meditations of a Modern Believer. He's editor of Poetry Magazine, the oldest monthly poetry magazine in the English-speaking world, and he's a poet himself. His Every Riven Thing won the 2011 Ambassador Book Award in Poetry. Christian Wyman, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
A Modern Believer. There's a lot about faith in this book, and there's a lot about poetry. We'll talk about faith. Did this experience leave you believing in poetry as an important way to confront life, even at potentially its end?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think I've always believed in poetry as a way of confronting your most urgent experiences. You know, Robert Frost was once asked as if poetry was a way of evading life or putting life to the side, and he laughed and said, hell no, it's a way of taking life by the throat. And I think I've always responded to poetry that manages to do that. It's a little bit different when you actually find yourself confronted life and death. You know, we tend to keep those things in the background. And when that happened, yes, I did find that my appetite for poetry had changed somewhat, and there were certain kinds of poetry that I had no time for and certain other poems that I desperately needed.
We want to try and take a little bit of this journey with you. There's a passage, it's fairly late in the book, but it describes where you've just had a bone marrow transplant and your sort of state of mind in the midst of some of this. This is a while after the first news. We'll come to that. But just to give us a kind of empathetic understanding of what your days and perspective may have been on this trip, could you read a little bit for us from that, Christian?
Sure. I have had a bone marrow transplant. I have been home from the hospital for 5 days. Among other side effects, it skinned me on the inside, leaving me so bloody and abraded from mouth to bowels that I couldn't even eat an aspirin. Even worse than that, though, was the way the Armageddon dose of chemo destroyed my mind so that I was unable to read even an ordinary magazine article, unable to follow a simple drama on television. I was in the hospital for several weeks, and the hours acquired a palpable thickness to them, like a pill impossible to swallow, some cure. By now the word is both radiant with and devoid of meaning, like faith, like God. You fight down at every instant because there is no other choice. You are out of options. And I am out of options.
Christian Wyman, reading there from My Bright Abyss. You know, we asked people online even before the show began. It's funny, it's a call-in show, but the interaction is really 24 hours, Christian. And we got lots of response from people with what had helped them through some traumatic moment, some passage, even their own brush with death. It is very interesting. We'll look at some of those. I mean, Derek Walcott comes up here, and Wendell Berry, and Daniel Ladinsky, his love poems from God. What happened to you 7 or 8 years ago, Christian? How did you find out that this was not going to be an ordinary stretch of time?
Well, I got the news actually on a voicemail message at work, which was pretty shocking. And
what was the news?
The news that I had, actually the news was simply that I had lymphoma, which can mean, if you've ever been in the cancer world, can mean anything. There are all kinds of lymphomas that are very curable. There are kinds that kill you quickly. It just means anything. And then my doctor vanished, and he's no longer my doctor. He vanished, and I couldn't even get in touch with him until this was on a Thursday, and I had the message that I had lymphoma but didn't know what kind, and I couldn't get in touch with him until the following Monday. And so I spent those days on the internet just, you know, like anyone does, getting increasingly panicked. And then I learned that I had this very rare lymphoma about which little is known, and it itself has further rarities, which even less known, has created further complications. And it was quite a long journey for my wife and I. We went through a period of time when I didn't need treatment, and then periods when I was quite sick, and have been through every kind of drug that you can give to this cancer until it finally culminated in the bone marrow transplant.
It put you on a couple of journeys, one deeper into your own faith and spirituality, another maybe deeper into your relationship, which was already deep, with poetry. You write about Wallace Stevens, and at one point in the book you write, you know, of course his famous line is, "Death is the mother of beauty." You write, "That's a phrase that could only have been written by a man for whom death was an abstraction, a vaguely pleasant abstraction at that." When it became no longer abstract at all for you, how did it change your taste in poetry? Seems too slight here. Your need, your urgent need in poetry.
Well, you know, death is a subject for young poets and young artists, and maybe even all young people. They like to flirt with death and think of it as a way of intensifying their life. It's an easy thing to grab hold on to because it happens to all of us, and you know it's going to happen. And yet, when you're young, it seems so far away that you can just sort of borrow its intensity. When it's right there in front of you, though, it's quite different. And the notion of Wallace Stevens is quite abstract. Death is the mother of beauty. Hence, from her alone shall come fulfillment to our dreams and our desires. Well, you know, maybe so. Maybe that's true at some point in your life that you need to think of death in order to concentrate on life. When death is right in front of you, I found that that kind of abstract thinking was poisonous to me, and that the only things that kept me alive and able to even concentrate on my life were things that brought life right in front of me. I mean, right in front of me. And so poems that were not abstract at all, but were absolutely concrete, and also absolutely concrete experiences that I had with the people around me. And so not religious experiences that somehow took me in some sort of transcendental way. That, too, I did not find possible or available to me. It was any religious experience I had was completely concrete. You know, Ernest Renan says there is another world, but it is in this one. And I think that's a helpful way to think of what that moment can do to your consciousness.
Well, look at what you read, but also what you wrote, being a poet yourself. And there's this passage, the title of your book comes from it, "My Bright Abyss," just four lines, but it came too early in this, I think. Could you read it for us?
Sure. You know, I had this, actually, it's probably been a decade ago that I had these four lines in my head, and I tried to finish the poem. They're the first four lines of a poem, and when I read it, you'll see why this would be such a difficult poem to finish. "My God, my bright abyss, into which all my longing will not go, once more I come to the edge of all I know, and believing nothing, believe in this." And so presumably the rest of the poem would have filled out what I believe.
But, right. And then comes the news of your own cancer, and soon you were writing a full-fledged poem. And let's go straight to it. It's "From a Window," written just a few months after getting your first diagnosis. Could you read it, Christian?
Sure. I went several years without writing poems at all, 3 years, actually. And for me, it's hard to overestimate the misery this caused me, because poetry had been my lifeline to the world and the way that I made contact with the world, the way I understood the world, and it all went silent. And
Better hold the reading then, because we're going to come up to a break here, but we'll get it as soon as we come back. This was your first, what you're saying, it took the sort of great jarring of this threat of death itself to get you going?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right, yes. It took two events, falling in love and then getting that diagnosis, to jolt me out of my silence.
We'll come to that poem. You also really came in to a big and urgent search to understand faith, religious faith, spirituality in this time.
Dwight Gardner reviews your book very nicely in the New York Times, and he says, you know, that you're under no delusion about the world's committed poetry readers being, for the most part, anything but a skeptical, dubious, scoffing gaggle when it comes to religious faith. But that wasn't you as this unfolded.
It wasn't. No, I've always been obsessed with matters of faith. And, you know, actually, I don't agree with Dwight Gardner in that. I do think we live in secular times, but I think poets in particular are those who are protecting a sense of the sacred. And even those poets who do not have religious belief, I find that they believe in something other, and that their poems sustain them in that and bring them to that belief. I don't find many poets, there are some, but I don't find many poets, certainly not as many as Dwight Gardner suggests, who are devoid of any faith whatsoever. I do find many, he's right that most wouldn't call themselves Christians or perhaps Muslims or Hindus or Jewish or whatever, what have you, but they do have some notion of what spirituality and the soul means.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about poetry and spirituality when the chips are really down, at death's door, with the editor of Poetry Magazine, Christian Wyman. 8 years ago, at 39, he was diagnosed with cancer, faced death. It changed the way he read and believed. He writes about it in his new book, My Bright Abyss, Meditations of a Modern Believer. He joins us today from Chicago, and you can join us as well. What poem, what passage do you share with friends who are up against it? And what about at death's door? What would you read or want to be read, hear recited? Does poetry merge, flirt with faith for you, or are they different paths for you? Lots of listeners sharing what's helped them. Simone writes on Facebook, Christian, One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. You know, the art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost, that their loss is no disaster. And that one goes on. You wrote From a Window soon after getting this diagnosis. Could you read it for us?
Sure. This is just a person standing at a window looking out and at a tree and seeing a flock of birds emerge from that tree. Incurable and unbelieving in any truth but the truth of grieving, I saw a tree inside a tree rise kaleidoscopically as if the leaves had livelier ghosts. I pressed my face as close to the pain as I could get to watch that fitful, fluent spirit that seemed a single being, undefined, or countless beings of one mind, haul its strange cohesion beyond the limits of my vision, over the house, heavenwards. Of course I knew those leaves were birds. Of course that old tree stood exactly as it had and would, but why should it seem fuller now? And though a man's mind might endow even a tree with some excess of life to which a man seems witness, that life is not the life of men. And that is where the joy came in.
Christian Wyman reading his From a Window. When you look back on that now, what were you trying to express, taking on board this new vivid mortality right there?
Pure grief. You know, the poem was born out of pure grief, incurable and unbelieving in any truth but the truth of grieving. And the great surprise, and I think a poem has to surprise you if it's ever going to be a real poem, you're not actually trying to express something. It exploded into a joy that I didn't expect. And I thought I was writing a lament, and it turned into a psalm. And it taught me something. And, you know, it taught me about the way that I was looking at life and that there were these seams of joy within what seemed like a black cloth of suffering.
You know, it's interesting. People take this seriously. They're responding online, and people have been through pain, and different things have helped them. A listener on Facebook says, many people mentioned the Psalms and the Bible, the Old Testament. Here's a listener who says, Dorothy Parker's resume You know, though, and this is very bleak, but, you know, it says, razors pain you, rivers are damp, acids stain you, and drugs cause cramp. Guns aren't lawful, nooses give, gas smells awful. You might as well live. Maybe someone who's stared at contemplated suicide right there in a tough time. You came to really love Craig Arnold, and especially his Meditation on a Grapefruit, of all things. Tell us about him and this poem and what it meant to you.
Oh, this Craig was a wonderful friend of mine. He was a friend of so many people. He died unexpectedly a few years ago. I guess it's been 5 or 6 years now. And he loved volcanoes. He had a poet's love for really exciting, powerful things. And he had a grant to travel around the world. He was writing a nonfiction book about volcanoes, and so he was. On one in Japan and went off for a hike. It was not a difficult hike, and he went by himself one evening, and he was never seen again, and his body was never found. They searched for him for, I think, a year. They brought in the most specialized sort of teams that you can have, and they never found him, and so he's just a person who has vanished. He's exactly my age. Craig sent this poem a couple of days before he vanished. I didn't even know he was in Japan. And I got to it the day that he disappeared. I didn't know that he disappeared. And that morning, and I read it, and I thought, oh, my God, this is amazing. And this is something that just seems meant for me and is so beautiful. And I emailed him immediately, and, of course, he never saw that email. I never heard from him. But we did publish the poem. It's called Meditation on a Grapefruit. To wake when all is possible before the agitations of the day have gripped you. To come to the kitchen and peel a little basketball for breakfast. To tear the husk like cotton padding, a cloud of oil misting out of its pinprick pores, clean and sharp as pepper. To ease each pale pink section out of its case so carefully without breaking a single pearly cell. To slide each piece into a cold blue china bowl, the juice pooling until the whole fruit is divided from its skin, and only then to eat, so sweet a discipline, precisely pointless, a devout involvement of the hands and senses, a pause, a little emptiness, each year harder to live within, each year harder to live without.
Craig Arnold's Meditation on a Grapefruit. They're read by Christian Wyman. What did that mean? You said you didn't want high concept. You wanted the very tangible, almost tactile feeling of life. You certainly got plenty of tactile right there.
Oh, yeah. It's just it's someone absolutely seizing a moment with the recognition that you can never seize a moment. Each year harder to live within, each year harder to live without. And so it has this mixed feeling to it, which I think is everyone's experience. It doesn't matter if you're going through trauma or not. It's everyone's experience of being in some moments and being outside of them. Even the moments in which we are most present, we are somehow self-conscious and thus outside of them. And this poem manages to enact that experience. It manages to make it happen to you while you're reading the poem. People might not notice, but it's unbelievably well crafted. It actually rhymes. There's all kinds of rhymes through here, and it seems to me a marvel of a poem. And I'm really sorry that he didn't see the kind of recognition that it's received.
It's almost here. It's going to unfold that we've almost got a kind of poetry poker going on. Our listeners are sending in so many of their own in response to you, Christian. Here's Cheryl just sending this in on Facebook, and you know what helped her, even maybe. Or others at death's door. This is Let Evening Come by Jane Kenyon. Let the light of late afternoon shine through chinks in the barn, moving up the bales as the sun moves down. Let the cricket take up chafing as a woman takes up her needles and her yarn. Let evening come. Let dew collect on the hoe abandoned in long grass. Let the stars appear and the moon disclose her silver horn. Let the fox go back to its sandy den. Let the wind die down, let the shed go black inside, let evening come. To the bottle in the ditch, to the scoop in the oats, to the air in the lung, let evening come. Let it come as it will, and don't be afraid. God does not leave us comfortless, so let evening come. Jane Kenyon's Let Evening Come, and she's got your the sort of material physicality right alongside the spirituality right back to you there, Christian.
Yeah, she suffered the same thing, you know. She had leukemia. She died of leukemia at an early age and wrote that poem out of a crisis. I mean, that is a very beautiful poem, I think. I'm actually close to her former husband, Donald Hall. So I have great fondness for Jane Kenyon, whom I'd never met, though. But I have great fondness for her memory, and that's a beautiful, beautiful poem.
Very beautiful. Let evening come. Let's bring our listeners right in. Carol in Portsmouth, Rhode Island. Carol, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a poet, and the way that I dealt with the breast cancer I had 20 years ago was to write a lot, and I ended up publishing a short chapbook called The Breast Cycle, A Journey of Dreams and Nightmares. But I have one title, and I'll just pick a couple lines from it.
Yes.
Death is a lion. Death is a lion staring me down, soft as a pussycat in gentle dreams. But she stalks me now, a ferocious roar of fear on this August dog day.
Carol, and that's your poem. Give us, if you will, your what name do you write under? Carol.
I write under Carol Anderhagen.
Very good. Death is a lion. Christian, did you feel it that way? Carol, thank you. Christian, did you visualize it when it became imminent?
Gosh, no. You know, I mean, we talk about poetry when poetry can help you, and when we haven't really talked about when it can't, and I have found that you reach a stage of pain where poetry is irrelevant, and nothing can help you but drugs, and that's what when I've been close to death, and it's only been twice. There's been nothing that could reach me, and that was the book faces that despair too, and is born out of that despair as well. So she mentions, I think she's right to get that complexity out of death, that sometimes there is a tenderness to it, and the Jane Kenyon poem that is a good example. And then at other times it is simply silence, and there's nothing there that you have to say.
Let's go to Jeannie in Montgomery, Alabama. Jeannie, thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a survivor of child abuse,
mm-hmm.
And as a child, you wonder whether you're going to make it out of it. It's not like, a diagnosis of cancer, but there was a poem as a small child. I don't know the title of it. It's very short. We flatter those we scarcely know. We please the fleeting guests, yet deal full many a thoughtless blow to those who love us best. And as a child, that comforted me in a way, because that's what was happening to me, but I knew that if I did survive, I didn't want to be that. I didn't want to be one of those who pleased the fleeting guests and dealt full many a thoughtless blow to those who loved me best.
Did it?
And I just wanted to share that with y'all.
Did it buoy you up? Even as a child, did those words have that meaning to you, or did you find it later in life and reflect back, Jeannie?
Oh, no, it was immediate. It was immediate, and I wish I knew the author. I've never been able to find out, but it was immediate, and it's been with me all my life. I've shared it with many friends.
I'm glad for the life raft. Recite it once more for us, Jeannie.
We flatter those we scarcely know. We please the fleeting guests, yet deal full many a thoughtless blow to those who love us best.
Jeannie, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Thanks very much. From Montgomery.
Thank you.
Jane in Newton, Massachusetts. Jane, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling to share a short four-line passage from a poem by Wordsworth called Michael. I had a lot of childhood abuse, suffered a lot of childhood abuse myself, and then in college discovered poetry, and it saved me as a young 20-something. But then when I had my own young 20-something teenager who fell into addiction and drugs, the same thing I'd suffered from as a child through my parents, I went back to this poem that I remembered, and it got me through it and it saved me.
Do you have it? Can you share it?
Yes. There's four lines from the poem Michael by Wordsworth. There is a comfort in the strength of love. 'Twill make a thing endurable, which else would overset the brain or break the heart.
Yeah.
He loses his child, Michael, in this poem, but I didn't, because it became endurable for me, knowing of the strength of my love.
Jane, thank you for sharing that one as well. Let me get one more right here. Cross in Pocatello, Idaho. Thank you, Jane. Cross, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
In 92, when I was 24 years old and had two kids in diapers, I was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. And so music and poetry were kind of pivotal to me getting through all of that. But the one that helped really keep perspective, I think, was The Desiderata by Max Ehrman. One of the things you mentioned was keeping perspective. I think cancer treatment makes you the most selfish person in the world for a while.
Selfish? Really? Are you saying selfish there because it's so hard? Is that what you're saying, Cross?
Pardon me?
Are you saying selfish because it's so difficult?
Well, no. Well,
or selfless?
It's very self-centered. Everything mm-hmm. is about you.
Yeah.
And so it was really nice to have the Desiderata and talk about things about the world. You know, go placidly amid the noise and haste and remember what peace there may be in silence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It mentioned about the fact that the world, with all of its sham and drudgery, still beautiful. There's still great things going on. It just gave me a good perspective.
Cross, I so appreciate that. Of course, we all know the lines from that, and I can hear the help it gave you. I mean, Christian, it is not news to us that words, you know, from scripture or poetry are incredibly powerful in difficult times. And yet, for most of us, until those times come, that's just a sort of a conceptual notion, or can be. What did you learn about the power of even the poetry that was your business?
Oh, I learned some of the things that these people have learned. You know, I'm really struck by, when I listen to these stories, I'm struck by three things. One is the power of memorization.
Yes.
And I've got little kids, and they are memorizing poems. And the one that Jeannie quoted reminded me of Robert Louis Stevenson. I don't know if that's who it is, but that's who it reminded me of.
Maybe.
But the other is the power of direct statement. You know, they all quoted poems that made direct statements, and we're used to poems and modern poems that avoid that. And I think one of the things that a lot of poets are returning to and finding courage to do is to make direct statements that the way that all of your listeners quoted. And I also think I'm struck by Cross's statement about his pain. I have a little bit different take. I think one of the things that it struck me is that our pain is not singular, that we hear all these stories that your listeners are giving us, and what they suggest is that our pain is archetypal, and the task is to see beyond our pain into those archetypes, the experience that we all have.
Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about poetry and spirituality when the chips are really down at death's door with the editor of Poetry Magazine, Christian Wyman. 8 years ago, he was 39, diagnosed with cancer, faced death. It changed the way he read and believed. We'll look at that as well. He writes about all of it in his new book, My Bright Abyss, Meditations of a Modern Believer. You can join us this hour. What do you hear in Christian Wyman's experience, his search for meaning, beauty, God? Is this not the way you'd go, turning to poetry volumes in faith? Do your eyes go elsewhere? Have words buoyed you up at a time of great, great trial? Christian Wyman joins us from Chicago. And Christian, we heard our Brooklyn singer with Osip Mandelstam's And I Was Alive. But this was an important one for you. I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about it and read it for us.
Sure. I translated a book of Mandelstam's. I did a little selection of his poems.
It was Polish,
at a time when I was quite sick,
mm-hmm.
and I did this one when I couldn't even get out of bed. I had a bone die in my leg and was spending a lot of time in bed, and so it was miserable. But at the same time, it enabled this this project, which was a wonderful project for me. Mandelstam died when he was in his 40s. He was sort of hounded to death by Stalin. And he was last seen picking through a garbage heap in Siberia, presumably for food. The last day that he wrote poetry, he wrote three poems or two poems, depending upon how they're edited. And this is one that I like to think of as his very last one. Just imagine that you know death is closing in on you and that you have the strength to do something like this. Mm-hmm. And I was alive in the blizzard of the blossoming pear. Myself I stood in the storm of the bird cherry tree. It was all leaf life and star shower, unerring, self-shattering power, and it was all aimed at me. What is this dire delight, flowering, fleeing, always earth? What is being? What is truth? Blossoms rupture and rapture the air, all hover and hammer, time intensified and time intolerable, sweetness, raveling rot. It is now. It is not.
Ossip Mandelstam's And I Was Alive. Was it your translation there, Christian Wyman?
It was. Yeah, it is my translation, and very much a version. Mandelstam is a poet of the ear and writes these great sonic wonders, one of the greatest lyric poets of the 20th century, and you can't bring that exactly into English. You have to kind of invent something else.
From his, was it Polish originally?
Russian.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I mean, the defiance there, when, as you describe what he was up against, just to write it is a kind of act of defiance, but also love of life, even as he's facing its end.
Oh, it's amazing. And the wonder is, you know, actually, he didn't write it. He walked around like Wordsworth. One of your callers mentioned Wordsworth mm-hmm. earlier. And like Wordsworth, he walked around and composed these things in his head and didn't write them down. And at the time, it was so dangerous to have written materials in your house like this, anything that was not simply a political statement, but almost just a spiritual statement could get you killed. And so the people around Mandelstam, his wife in particular, Nadezhda Mandelstam, memorized these poems and kept them in their heads long after he died, and then finally wrote them down, you know, when it could safely be done. And so it's an astonishing story of how these poems have survived and come down to us.
Blossoms rupture and rapture the air, all hover and hammer, time intensified and time intolerable. You grew up in West Texas, Baptist, I think it was.
Kind of. That's right. Yeah,
drifted
right.
From that. There's much in your book, My Bright Abyss, about your searching for faith and taking solace in it as well when you're up against it here. What about the comforts or insights of poetry alongside or as opposed to religion, faith, spirituality, when things really got tough? Which provided what for you and in what weight, Christian?
It's hard for me to separate them. You know, the reason I think poetry is so important to any kind of integrated spiritual life or unified spiritual life is because we can only speak of God metaphorically. There is no way that you can make direct statements about God. They don't make any sense. And I mean, all of our pronouns, he or she, those don't make any sense. And we can only speak of God in terms of metaphor. And poetry is the most concentrated and explosive use of metaphor that you'll find anywhere, which is why so much of all of the scriptures of all of the religions are in poetry. So it's very much raveled up for me, my experience of poetry and my experience of God, or rather my experience of the word and language as I experience it. I have a hard time separating the two.
Were you fighting the streams of contemporary or recent poetry to try and swim through that towards spirituality, as you know, Dwight Garner was kind of suggesting in his review? Or did you find that your contemporaries and recent, or even just modern poets, helped you arrive there?
I guess there's two answers. I think there is definitely a movement towards finding meaning and towards making statements in poetry, as I said before. And so I did not feel alone in that. I do feel there's a widespread tendency in contemporary poetry to be concerned only with language itself and to write poems that are essentially only intelligible to other poets. And I'm certainly conscious of fighting against that, but gosh, there are a lot of people doing that. And you can look at a poet like Richard Wilbur, who's been around for so long. He's in his 90s now, and think of a little stanza that he wrote, like, "Joy's trick is to supply dry lips with what can cool and slake, leaving them dumbstruck also with an ache nothing can satisfy." Isn't that wonderful? I mean, it goes to the heart of how our experience, even our best experiences, leave us somehow hungering for something beyond them. It's not just despair that leads you to God. It's joy, actually. It's joy, first of all.
Even when we're in trouble, with dry lips and need to be cooled and slaked. Meredith in Savannah, Georgia is calling. Meredith, you're on the air with Christian Wyman. Hi, Meredith.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. The show is so deeply moving today. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. What's helped you, Meredith?
The poem called "The Layers" by poet laureate Stanley Kunitz. I'm a 2-time breast cancer survivor, and the second diagnosis 3 years after my first recovery was pretty devastating for me. And I coped through writing and through poetry, but they were my drug. They were better than, you know, anything a doctor could give me to get me better. I'm happy to say I'm doing well 2 years later.
That's so good.
But Stanley Kunitz's "The Layers" just spoke to me in that spiritual tone, and I feel everything that Christian is saying held true for myself.
Do you have it? Could you share a little bit of it with us?
I do. It's I can happy to read it. It's, I don't know how many minutes, but I'll start. "The Layers. I have walked through many lives, some of them my own, and I am not who I was, though some principle of being abides from which I struggle not to stray. When I look behind, as I am compelled to look, before I can gather strength to proceed on my journey, I see the milestones dwindling towards the horizon and the slow fires trailing from the abandoned campsite over which scavenger angels wheel on heavy wings. Oh, I have made myself a tribe out of my true affection, and my tribe is scattered. How shall the heart be reconciled to its feast of losses? In a rising wind, the manic dust of my friends, those who fell along the way, bitterly stings my face. Yet I turn, exalted somewhat, with my will intact to go wherever I need to go, and every stone on the road precious to me. In my darkest night, when the moon was covered and I roamed through the wreckage, a nimbus clouded voice directed me, live in the layers, not on the litter. Though I lack the art to decipher it, no doubt the next chapter in my book of transformations is already written. I am not done with my changes."
Stanley Kunitz, "The Layers." How did you end up interpreting it, Meredith? Live in the layers, not in the litter. What did it say to you?
I had this amazing transformation on chemo when I was kind of curled up in bed, that my life was going through a transformation or a metamorphosis. And I had this awakening of there was more meaning to my life than the way I had been living it. And perhaps that the second diagnosis of cancer was essential to me living a newer, more authentic life. And so I was no longer living in the litter. I was not being so superficial or not so concerned with materialistic things. And I was learning to decipher the true meaning of how my life should go, what direction it should take.
Meredith, we're glad for your progress.
Thank you for that opportunity.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's a tough way to get it, but there it is, and you've seized it and now shared it with us. Thank you so much, Meredith. Christian, you quote Seamus Heaney saying, "Glimmerings are what the soul's composed of." And maybe that's right here as well. You can hear Meredith in her search, her anguish, and finding those glimmerings in there from Stanley Kunitz.
Yeah, and you know, this is one of the great things about poetry is that it can give you those moments, those glimmerings that help to make up your soul. And I think also so many people are frustrated with the language of Christianity. You can hear on this program that people are reaching for some language to describe experiences for which ultimately they don't quite have language, and so they reach for these poems to express it. And that's exactly what poetry is for. It's to give us a language for things that otherwise we wouldn't be able to say. And we don't have to write those poems. They exist. We can find them everywhere. And I think that's one of the great things that I think poetry is actually doing right now is remaking the language of faith. And religion had better pay attention.
Yeah, of course, your search was in Christianity. We'll have listeners searching in many religions or none, but poetry maybe as a signpost for all. Pat in Worcester, Massachusetts. Pat, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Christian, thanks for sharing all your experiences with us. I called initially to share an experience when I was young. I deferred engineering school to work in the field, and I started working as a steel worker and climbing steel, assembling steel in big buildings and welding. And I was out for a motorcycle ride, and I looked up, and there was a wayward truck heading my way, and it crushed me. Next thing I knew, I was waking up. I had lost a leg, broken my hips, broken my back, and I had laying there in pain. For days, I couldn't sleep. And a friend of mine brought a CD into me, and it was George Harrison's All Things Must Pass. And I never really listened to the song the way I did that night. And it struck me, you know, there were some verses in the song that I never really heard. You hear things and you don't listen to them. You know, like yes. Robert Frost, you read Robert Frost, but you don't listen to it. And when life throws a curve at you, and you're facing death, or you're facing the end of your life as you know it, you see new meaning in things that you never noticed before. Like in All Things Must Pass, there's a couple of verses that says, "All things must pass, none of life's strings can last, so I must be on my way and face another day.
Yeah.
Now the darkness only stays the nighttime, in the morning it will fade away. Daylight is good at arriving at the right time, it's not always going to be this gray." And for the life of me, I never heard those lyrics in that song before, you know?
Until you were flattened.
And I was flattened, and I slept.
Yeah.
And I slept that night. And I woke up the next day, everything was different. And I was never a religious person, and I'm still not. And what occurred to me that at that point was that God didn't exist as we were taught in Catholic school or in the Bible or anything. God was manifested himself or itself or existed in people and what they created. And whether it was a 68 Corvette or a great poem or aircraft carrier or the pyramids, it's just the way people do things for each other, you know, the way they give messages to each other and communicate to each other in good ways and bad, you know, not always a good way, but
Pat, you've brought it right back to us from that moment. That's something to share when you were so deeply knocked down, and you bring it back to us through the lyrics here of George Harrison, kind of poetry in their own right. We're up against the clock here, Pat, but I appreciate your call. I mean, you write something like that, Christian. You say, what one wants during extreme crisis is not connection with God, but connection with people, not supernatural love, but human love. And then you say that's not quite right. There is something almost supernatural that is wanted too, Christian.
Yeah, I think the caller's statement was fantastic, actually. There's a real genius to the notion that our imaginations are one way of which God manifests himself or herself to us, that the way in which we reach out to each other through poems or through making things or through having conversations can be themselves sacred experiences when we let them be. And I do think you have to release yourself and let there be some something outside of those experiences. You have to understand that there is something other for those experiences to attain their true meaning. But to be a believer does not mean to value the transcendent over the concrete. And I think many of your callers have been saying that very thing.
You've got, among yours, Anna Kaminska, with a prayer that will be answered. Let me walk through silence and leave nothing behind, not even fear. Christian Wyman, we are grateful that you shared this experience with us, the poems, the kind of psychological, spiritual arc of your turn up out of that bad moment. We're glad you're robustly with us here today, Christian. And thank you for that. Bless you. Bless you even. What's your next plan? You're still editing Poetry Magazine and then?
No, I'm on my way to the Yale Institute of Sacred Music and Yale Divinity School, actually. I'm leaving poetry in June and becoming a teach at the Divinity School. So it's a big change. But thanks a lot for having me here today. It's been wonderful.
Wonderful for us as well. My Bright Abyss is the book. Christian Wyman, we wish you the best of luck. Listeners, thanks for everything you've shared online and right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.